Thanks for joining us for this Eastern Standard special series, Democracy Optimus, produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Our series is written and hosted by Joshua Douglas, professor of election law and voting research in the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Before we begin this episode of Eastern Standard, we have a special message. The week we are recording this episode, the University of Kentucky Law School lost a cherished member, Professor Bill Fortune. Bill was the first person to welcome my wife and I to Lexington, Kentucky, driving us all around town when I was hired. He actually took my election law class as a student, and then, without my prior knowledge, wrote a glowing review for my tenure file. He's one of only two people who read my entire forthcoming book and offered meaningful comments to make it better. Bill was a champion of Lexington and Kentucky as a whole, and he always encouraged me to use my scholarship to try to engage the public and improve voting laws. As this episode is about the power of local activism to protect democracy, we dedicate this episode of Democracy Optimist to Bill. I think a lot about the famous quote from Jackie Robinson, "A life is not important except for the impact it has on other lives." Bill had a big impact on everyone he touched.
What does it mean to be American?
Throughout the 2024 election season, we'll be bringing you conversations with election and voting experts from across the political spectrum so that when you go to the polls on November 5th, you'll arrive fully informed about how it all works. Again, here's Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Today, we are thrilled to speak with Richard Young, who is the executive director of Civic Lex, an organization in Lexington, Kentucky, that is focused on civic engagement and community development. Full disclosure, I'm on the board of Civic Lex, but that's because I'm passionate about its mission. Richard, welcome to Democracy Optimist. So you started Civic Lex in 2017. It's been 6 years now. Tell us about the organization, what prompted you to start it, and what it does.
Yeah, so Civic Lex is a interesting organization. We haven't found too many others out there in the country like us. You know, we originally started around trying to find ways to get people more engaged with local government. So we started by covering city meetings, much like local news organizations do, really focusing on the sort of smaller committee meetings and subcommittee meetings that just don't get the kind of attention that they should. And then we also, you know, hosted these sort of in-person events that would bring together elected officials, city staff, and the public to really meet each other in physical space. Because, you know, one of the things that we know is that relationships with people inside city government just make it a lot easier for people to get engaged. It makes it less intimidating, makes it so that you can call someone if you know them personally. And so that's sort of how we started and what our focus was. And over time, over that 6 years, we had a series of realizations, I think, that sort of caused us to shift our scope a little bit. So the first one was that getting people more informed and engaged about what's happening in their community is important, but it can also backfire on you. I remember a very specific instance where I was talking with someone who came to one of our we had workshops on the city budget, sort of help people understand what the budget is, you know, how it gets created. And I remember a very specific instance of someone coming and joining us for one of our workshops, getting sort of inspired and excited about getting involved in the sort of creation of this important public document. And they, you know, went to some city hall meetings and found that that process for engaging didn't meet up to what their expectations were, right? They showed up and the opportunity to actually speak on the budget took place after the vote on the budget had already happened.
Well, that's not really helpful.
It's not
right?
particularly helpful.
So let me back up first for a second to ask, why should people care about local government and local elections? I mean, we hear so much news, the media focuses on the presidential election. You're focused on, you know, the nitty-gritty ground level, what's happening in one city. why does it affect people's lives and why should we care?
That's such a great question. And I think, you know, there's so much harm that has come from, I feel like, this sort of nationalization of politics, I'm sure we can go into. But, you know, local government is the level that affects people's lives the most directly, right? It helps shape what the neighborhoods you live in look like. It helps shape the roads that you drive on. It helps shapes what kind of businesses you can go to. These decisions, and, you know, part of this is in the design of America, the American system of government and the concept of federalism. But local government and local decision-making is inherently the most directly impactful. It's also the level at which people have the least amount of information. Studies nationally show us it's the level at which people are the most optimistic about actually getting engaged doing something. There's a pretty significant difference when you look at studies from Gallup and others. And it's the level at which one person can actually make a pretty significant difference, right? One person showing up to a committee meeting or showing up to a council meeting and presenting a perspective that may not have originally been considered can actually change things. And so it's the most impactful. It's the level that's closest to you. It's the level which people have the most hope and haven't gotten jaded on like they have on national politics. And it's the level that it's the easiest to impact. And so those four things sort of in combination with each other really show us that it's the level at which we really need to be getting people more engaged to try and build this virtuous cycle of engagement.
Yeah, and of course, I love that ideal of optimism about what's possible. I mean, I named this entire show Democracy Optimist because to me, you know, with all the doom and gloom out there, one solution or response is to throw up our hands in despair and think you can't change the system. Your organization is proving that you can change the system, even at the local level, and perhaps in the areas that affect people's everyday lives the most. So one thing I wanted to talk about is I love your events that engage the community because you've somehow found the magic way of bringing people together from opposing viewpoints, people who are, you know, think so differently from one another about the direction of the country, about policy issues, and you get them talking in a way that I think is really unique and is a model that we should think about for how we talk to each other in general and certainly how our national politics should operate. So how have you done that? What's the method for getting people to engage with one another, especially when they are opposing each other?
That's a great question. You know, I think that a lot of people, when they think about politics, immediately go to our points of disagreement, right? These are these loud, flashy issues that are important, don't get me wrong. But there are so many other areas and opportunities where we can have more productive conversations. And working at the local level really highlights those, right? People don't get as animated about, you know, snowplow plans as they do about, you know, really high profile national issues. And so if we want to find opportunities for people to come together and meet people that are different from each other, from themselves, we have to do it around issues where people are actually open to dialogue. And so that's the first thing, right? And the local level presents us with a lot of those. The second thing that we, you know, really focus on in these sorts of events is making it so that dialogue isn't necessarily the sole focus of the event, right? Like there is a particular group of people, I count myself amongst them, that are particularly nerdy that like are like, yeah, I want to come and like talk with someone that thinks differently than me. Like that's a small group of people. But if we can make these events something that's a little more social, a little more appealing, and then have dialogue with, you know, with folks from different perspectives and different backgrounds and different experiences be part of it, but not the sole focus, it can be really impactful, right? So, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples. So we hosted an event in the fall of last year that focused on how our city builds parks, which sounds, you know, like something that may be kind of boring, but there's actually a lot of really interesting history there that ranges from, you know, issues around segregation, right? Because Lexington, like every other American city, had segregated parks up until not that long ago, right? In my parents' lifetime. And policies around taxation and policies around all of these different things, right? Go into this important topic. And parks are something that people care about a lot. And so we wanted to have an event where we could bring folks together to talk about the various issues around the history of parks in Lexington. And so instead of, you know, saying, all right, we're going to come meet someone from across the aisle and talk about the history of segregation in parks, which doesn't necessarily sound appealing to everyone. We made it about crafting, right? We made it about building building little birdhouses and building different things that you could put in your parks, but then had opportunities to have these conversations with someone that might have a completely different set of experiences than you. And importantly, for us and our work, we also make sure that decision makers, right, folks from city council, folks from the city's parks and rec department, from planning, from the bodies that set policy for these issues, they're in the room, right? And they're engaging with people. They're not in the room in like an authoritative way or like, you know, we're going to present to you about this issue. They're right there building birdhouses out of, you know, sort of little wicker baskets right alongside you. And so you get a chance to connect, you know, if you're an everyday resident showing up, you get a chance to connect with an elected official or city staff. But if you're on the city staff side of things, you get a chance to hear from people in a different way than sort of getting yelled at in a gymnasium, which is, I feel like, what most city government folks feel like the process of engagement is.
Yeah. You know, and what's amazing to me is that it's almost the purest form of democracy, right? It's citizens getting out to their community and interacting in a meaningful way with their elected officials, getting to see what these people are really like when they're not, you know, trying to ask for your vote or trying to convince you of whatever pet project they're trying to enact. So how do we emulate that across the country? How do we take this model and really fix our politics through what's happening at Civic Lex and in Lexington?
You know, I think it's going to take a lot of individuals and organizations in communities insisting that this civic life at the local level is what's important, right? You know, no national organizations are going to come in and fix this across the country because these issues are just so granular and so dependent on our everyday lives and in the sort of context of our communities. So it's really going to take people looking at our civic life nationally and saying, I think we can do better, and I think I can do better in my community, and looking for ways to do that. We have tons of resources on our website that people are welcome to steal and use in their own communities. Everything we do is in the Creative Commons, so we have no copyright on it. And, you know,
that's civiclex.org, by the way.
Civiclex.org, exactly. And, you know, something we always, you know, ask people to do is just directly reach out to us. You know, we are more than willing to talk with folks about how we do our work and the sort of process and share resources to help other people build something similar in their communities. Because ultimately, that's really what it's going to take, right? We're such a big and spread out country. It is going to take people understanding that there is a better way of existing with our neighbors and our communities and insisting upon that in their own places.
So I heard another interview you gave in which you talked about the power of a direct phone call or direct text to your acquaintances, your friends, your family members to provide accurate factual information. Why is that powerful, and how does someone go about doing that? I mean, you know, we're trying to think about a tangible thing we can take away. This seems something like, okay, I could text my friend something. Why do that, and how to do it?
You know, I think these days there's so much information out there, right, on the internet. Through social media, you know, we're constantly bombarded with information. There's a really interesting study that the Knight Foundation did a couple years ago about one of the sort of findings was that the sheer amount of information made it much more challenging for people to feel informed, which is really interesting, right? There's sort of a contradiction in that. But I think all of us have had an experience. We've been at the grocery store and we're like looking at 15 different brands of something and you're like, I don't know which box mac and cheese to get. But if we have a friend, someone that's or a family member, someone that we really trust, say, you know, I really like this particular one, we're more likely to choose that. And so one of the things that I like to, you know, tell people is that that individual trust that you have with people, that is the sort of essential connective tissue of our civic life, right? People are inherently much more likely to listen to you if they're related to you or if you have a pre-existing relationship or friendship. And so it's really important to be that sort of steward of good information for your community. And one of the things that I learned very early on in doing this work was a dear friend of mine said, you know, no matter what you're doing, when you're working in community, The thing you need to ask yourself after every sentence, after every thought is that true? And for all of us, that's not necessarily a go-to thing that we think of all the time to immediately think, can I verify this? And so I think it's absolutely critical for folks to have those moments of reflection and then be stewards of good information, because those relationships and that trust is so important.
Yeah, and of course, we got to be careful not to share falsehoods, right? So
exactly.
Ask yourself that, is this shareable because I can verify it's true before sharing it? All right, as we finish up our conversation, let me ask you this. Are you optimistic about voting in elections coming into the 2024 election season? You know, we hear so much doom and gloom. Are you optimistic or not?
I am optimistic. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I think this is going to be a rough election year, you know, nationally. But I think everywhere I look around the country, you know, because of my work with CivicLex, I have a really interesting vantage point on folks doing work in communities across the country, trying to strengthen the sort of civic health of their communities. And there are so many people doing so much excellent work, from, you know, bringing people together across difference to finding opportunities to, you know, get residents more engaged in the sort of local news process, to, you know, opportunities to really connect folks in a way that they've never really been connected before. There are organizations that are seeing that as essential to what they do and as essential to the strength of their communities. And so I think what we have is faith in our civic life and faith in each other.
So let me follow up with that to ask, what's one thing that listeners can do to support civic engagement in democracy? One tangible thing that listeners can take away from our conversation that they can do?
If I were to suggest the first thing for folks to getting more engaged in civic life and trying to strengthen the civic health of their communities, is learn who their local elected officials are and reach out to them. Elected officials, especially at the local level, council members, mayors, and folks down the ballot in county races, they are used to hearing from people in moments of crisis, right? That is when they typically hear from the public. And what I would recommend to folks is reach out and say, hey, I want to thank you for your service, because being an elected official is a civic service. It's a civic duty. It's hard. And I want to know what I can do to help strengthen my community. And I think people will be very surprised by the result they get. Knowing who your elected officials are and actively working to strengthen civic health in your own community is something that everyone can do in small ways and in really big ways.
I love that, because it's about let me help you. And then when you need the help from them, you know, they'll know who you are. So that's, I think, a really positive thing to think about, the power of local democracy. Richard, this was such a great conversation. Richard Young, the executive director of CivicLex, thank you so much for being on Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Josh, that was an interesting reminder by Richard Young how truly important it is that we train our focus on taking care of things on the local level. And with that in mind, if you had to single out an important election law that everybody needs to know about, what would that be?
So civic education is so important to democracy, and it goes hand in hand with election law and voting rights. So today I wanted to highlight our own state of Kentucky and the new Kentucky Civics Seal. This program will recognize students at all grade levels, K through 12, who show, quote, exceptional civic performance regarding local, state, and national governance. They'll get a recognition at graduation and a special seal on their diploma. And this year, 10 high schools in Kentucky are piloting the program. What's really interesting about this is that it doesn't require students to memorize the Declaration of Independence or the preamble to the Constitution. You know, that stuff is important, but it's kind of boring to most people. I mean, I love it, right? I teach election law and constitutional law, so I think that stuff is great. But, you know, high school students don't want additional memorization. Instead, the Kentucky Civic Seal program uses best practices of civics education to engage students to solve real-world problems through tangible projects. You know, we see some states doing things like, oh, we're going to fix civics education, so we're going to have a high school requirement B, you've got to pass the same citizenship test that new citizens have to pass. That's rote memorization. Here, we're focused on tangible, real-world projects that can actually change things.
That's really great. I feel like we've drifted away from that kind of education that supports civic engagement. And it's so, so important, as we're finding out in this election year.
Yeah. And, you know, for my first book in 2019, a book called Vote for Us, I have a chapter on civics education. And one of my favorite stories from that chapter comes from Washington, D.C., where this high school social studies teacher decided to engage his students in an action civics project. And without, you know, revealing all the details of what happened, this classroom went to the D.C. City Council and convinced them to let kids ride free on the buses and the metro. And it, you know, improved transportation and reduced tardiness in the school as a result. That's a great example of actually engaging students in demonstrating the power of local government and the power of their voices.
All right. There are a lot of conversations going on right now in this election season, and it's always good when you're in one of those to have this juicy piece of information that you can wow your friends and family with. So if you would give us a fun election fact.
So, you know, we all love receiving the I voted sticker after we vote. But during the American Revolution, we didn't have I voted stickers. Instead, there was election cakes. So people usually
like that better. That's
it sounds great, right? It kind of reminds me of Australia, where they have democracy sizzles for the democracy sausage that people have. It's a big party at the polls. And so people go vote and they have their democracy sausage in Australia. We sort of had something similar to that with election cakes. So people, usually women, of course, who were not able to vote then, but they would go to the polls and bring their election cakes to give to voters. The first recipe for an American election cake appears in 1796 in the first U.S. cookbook, Amelia Simmons's American Cookery. So, you know, I'll be busy on election day, but I'm hopeful to also whip up some election cake because it sounds like a great tradition that we should bring back.
Do we know what flavor that cake was by any chance?
So I looked up the recipe, actually, and it was kind of bland. I'm a big chocolate fan. There was no chocolate in it. It was kind of like a vanilla pound cake. But I think you can, you know, have your own variations, I'm sure.
Why don't we put that recipe on our website?
That sounds like a great idea.
So,
and if anyone wants to make it for us, I'm always welcome to take some cake.
What one thing, Josh, one thing can we do to support democracy?
You know, one of the points of the Democracy Optimist show is to give individuals tangible action items to feel like we all can make a change in sustaining our democracy in a positive way. You know, Richard Young talked about this. If you see a family member or a friend spreading election lies, foundering for the truth, reach out directly with the facts. You know, a gentle phone call, a gentle text can make a world of difference. You know, let's not spread misinformation. Let's have a skeptical eye. You know, is this AI that is, you know, that is peddling these falsehoods? You know, what is the truth? Let's go to respected sources and, you know, send a link to someone and say, hey, I thought this is interesting. I saw you talking about this issue on social media. I thought you might be also interested in this topic or this take on things. So look for verifiable information and spread it with your network.
Coming up in a moment, as editor of an election-focused news outlet, Jessica Huseman has to ask herself,
how do I get people to care about an election that's not even happening until November?
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
This is WEKU arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Sunday, March 10th, the Church of the Holy Trinity in Georgetown will host Speakers Bureau, the Cane Ridge Revival, the great revival that transformed Kentucky, presented by Eddie Price. The show will begin at 3 p.m. On Thursday, March 14th, the Highlands Museum and Discovery Center in Ashland will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Alice Lloyd. Stay on, stranger. The show will begin at 6 p.m. And also on Thursday, March 14th, the Family Resource Center in Crab Orchard will host Speakers Bureau, Homemaking on the Kentucky Frontier, presented by Eddie Price. This program will begin at 9 a.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Democracy Optimist, an election year special series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
Did you know that there is a news organization dedicated solely to covering issues of voting rights? VoteBeat provides an innovative approach to journalism and democracy. Today, we are pleased to welcome Jessica Huseman, the editorial director of VoteBeat, a nonprofit newsroom that covers all things election-related, including a lot about the nuts and bolts aspects of how elections actually operate. Their weekly newsletter is indispensable. Jessica, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you. That was a fabulous introduction. I am flattered.
I try. So tell us a little bit about VoteBeat. How did it start? What does it do today?
VoteBeat was sort of an odd accidental idea that Elizabeth Green, who is the CEO of Civic News Company, which used to just be called ChalkBeat because that was their only news organization, and she ran ChalkBeat at the time, wanted to come up with another news organization. So ChalkBeat covers K-12 news. She wanted another beat, right? What else can we cover? The 2020 election was underway, and they decided to create a pop-up newsroom. And at that time, I wasn't involved, but when they decided to make it permanent, I came in as editorial director. And so now we are in Texas, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and we are currently hiring a reporter in Wisconsin. So if any Wisconsin people are listening and would like to apply for a job, it is open.
It sounds like a great opportunity. And so you have these reporters in these handful of states, and then you're sort of directing things from the national level. So should we think of VoteBeat as a national newsroom or a cluster of different news or, you know, news groups in each of these different states?
That's a really good question. I like to think of VoteBeat as a local newsroom that is sort of networked together. And so the philosophy really behind all of Civic News is that we can support more journalism if we centralize editing and fundraising and administrative stuff and let the journalists do their journalism. And so all of our journalists are based in the state that they cover. The editors are wherever, and we do the work that they need us to do when they need us to do it. So I'm typically in charge of projects, but that doesn't mean I'm a national projects editor. I just go between our five states when there's an investigation that a reporter needs assistance with.
So VoteBeat's the only newsroom that's dedicated solely to covering election law, essentially, and election legislation and voting rights. Why do you think that is? Why aren't more news organizations focusing their resources in the way that you all are?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I think that I started covering this beat as an intern at ProPublica in 2016, and it was kind of an accident, right? They got some funding to do this huge project on election administration called Election Land. And they were like, oh, you run this now. And that was the introduction I had to election administration, right? Like this was not part of some grand plan. And so it's taken me that long to become confident enough in my knowledge of this space that I can direct a newsroom that covers that. And I think that that's really the answer. Like, newsrooms don't do this because it requires such a large amount of specified knowledge. And newsrooms, as you might have seen, are sort of shedding employees like you would not believe. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of taking on a beat that requires this much sort of investment can be a little bit overwhelming. But that is part of the reason that VoteBeat's stories are Creative Commons licensed and anyone can publish them.
And you know, that's maybe the frustrating thing, too, is that, you know, this VoteBeat is something that affects all of us. You know, it's just the sort of thing that the general public does need to understand. And yet these things can be so complicated. And so to that end, your reporting often covers the really nitty gritty stuff of election administration. You talk about things like ERIC, which is a multi-state database for voter registration where states can share their lists and thereby help to update the voter registration lists. You talk about problems at the Election Assistance Commission, this organization, this federal agency that no one really knows about that's supposed to help states and counties run their elections. So how do you engage the public? How do you engage voters on what really sounds like inside baseball?
Yeah, you know, this is like the daily challenge that I face, right? It's like, how do I get people to care about an election that's not even happening until November, right? Like, that's how people think about elections. And so this has actually been sort of an interesting thing to explain internally in my company, because it's a K-12 education company and a voting company, right? K-12 education, you have a stagnant daily audience of kids going to school, or at least parents wishing their kids were in school. Hmm. Voting happens like for people once every 2 or every 4 years. So it's...
Well, hopefully they're participating in the primaries too. So maybe a couple times during the year.
couple of times a year. But like if we're talking about your average American participating in this, you know, so it's not something that people have on their mind all the time. So we really do have to tap into a couple of things. So one, we have to tell the stories as if we are talking to someone who doesn't know anything about voting. We have to make them approachable. But then also, there are stories that really aren't approachable and cannot become approachable, and they're not really intended for Joe voter, right? They are intended for policymakers who are thinking about this. They're intended for election administrators. Because what we realized as we were sort of standing up VoteBeat was that not only are voters underserved in terms of their ability to share and find good information about the voting process, so are election administrators, and so are people in the space themselves and legislators who would make better decisions about the legislation that they pass given better information. And so we're sort of seeking to fill the gap that the public has, but also the gap that people who are making decisions about this every day in a way that most voters are not sort of see and engage with on a daily basis.
Yeah, I find that really frustrating sometimes when I speak to legislators who think they know about election administration, and, you know, they're theory as well. I ran in an election and I won. So and I have to gently tell them running for election doesn't mean you know how to run an election.
Right. And I think that you know, you would hear, and I'm sure that everybody who's listening to this knows a teacher, right? And it's the same thing that somebody would say if they tried to give them teaching advice and they were like, oh, I was once a student, right? Like, just because you were a student and maybe even a good one doesn't necessarily mean you can teach. And so it's just a very different perspective.
Yeah. Now, you focus a lot also on county clerks, the people who are at the front lines of running elections. Maybe this is the same question, but I think it's important to hear again. You know, why do you focus on these individuals, and how do we convince the public to care about the county clerk as much as they care about the president?
This is among my top issues in life, I think. So the county clerk is such an important figure, and it has so much influence over the way that most people engage in municipal government, right? Because not only do they manage elections, they also manage like titles and licenses. Like, there are a lot of things that these folks do. They provide a lot of services to the county. And so I think that the lack of coverage of them has both made it easier for them to get away with sort of like not advancing their processes as quickly as they otherwise would if they were better in the spotlight. But it has also meant that they don't have access to good information, because I think that people sort of underestimate how much information clerks get from local media, or how much information clerks get from the media alerting them to a problem. And local media is going away, right? And so we're both sort of letting those offices go without coverage, and also not providing the coverage those offices need in order to really be responsive to the public interest. And so that I think is a really important hole to fill. And I'm hopeful that we are at least trying to do that.
Yeah. And that's one of the themes of this show, right, is to shed a light for the public on how these things actually work on the ground level, because that's where it actually has the biggest influence. So you said on a PBS interview that there's a fine line between advocating for change and giving people the impression that the system is too flawed so that they don't participate at all. Let's listen in.
There is a fine line between very loudly advocating for change and then going so far that you sort of push people over to thinking that there's no point and there's no point in engaging with the system at all.
All right. So how do we strike that balance?
I think it's a hard balance to strike. It's true. I think that what I would advocate is that people take a solutions-oriented approach to criticizing a system, right? I think what we're seeing a lot of is big, broad criticisms of systems that ultimately have no solutions because the problems they're pointing out are sort of inherent to the systems themselves, right? Like, we assume a certain amount of risk depending on which voting method we choose, but that may come with more or less access. And that's sort of a cost-benefit analysis that everyone has to do. And so I think that the people who get lost in this discussion, where people are advocating for change, are the people who just like stop being able to access voting or stop being able to want to access voting because they can't sort of see a solution, right? So Republicans are agitating against vote by mail. That's sort of a disagreement within the party. I think we all saw in the 2020 election, and especially in the runoff in Georgia, how influential that the choice to not participate in vote by mail was, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. There weren't a lot of other options. There weren't good solutions to the problems that they were pointing out because the problems weren't real. And so they just chose not to participate. And so at some point, the advocacy tips over into people feeling like the system is just not workable and won't serve their needs. And so they opt out of participating altogether, or they're left with very few opportunities to participate. And so they can't.
And of course, that, you know, is a problem for democracy, whichever side it's affecting, you know, whichever party's supporters are not coming out to vote. And that leads me to my next question. So, you know, the head of one of our two major political parties seems to be rejecting democracy itself in many ways. And, you know, I find it really important in my own scholarship and advocacy to remain nonpartisan. I know that journalists do as well, right? They're really trying hard to be an independent voice of transparency and to be nonpartisan. And yet you've got Donald Trump attacking democracy, you know, promoting the myth of voter fraud, as you already mentioned, encouraging his supporters not to use mail-in voting during the pandemic, and of course, refusing to accept election results before any votes are cast. So how do journalists handle this difficulty of covering, one of the two major political party candidates in a way that's fair, but also in a way that protects democracy?
Yeah, so I think that journalists need to recognize that, at least in the United States, our role in democracy is pretty well defined historically, right? Like, the reason that freedom of the press is written into the Bill of Rights is because the founders envisioned that we would do something to further democracy, right? Like, we would help keep the voting public engaged and apprised of what was going on so that they could knowledgeably vote, right? And so that assumes that people should be able to vote, right? And it also assumes that they should be able to do so with appropriate and like true information. And so I think that if there are two candidates and one is saying a lot of not true things and the other one isn't saying as many untrue things, then the weight of stories should reflect that difference. And so, you know, I think that it should be seen as less the media making a call on what to cover and more the media making sure that the information on balance that people are receiving has been appropriately checked such that people can participate as knowledgeable voters.
And I guess that means that there shouldn't be a both sides of every story, right? That perhaps the media, you know, too much both sides things in 2016 and failed to call out some of the blatant lies in that way. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I do. I think it's a fair assessment. And I think that there were a lot of media companies that sort of took a step back from going as far as they could on quickly and very sort of like aggressively debunking things that he said early on, especially when he was running for president that first time. I think it was so unique to be confronted with a candidate that was saying those things that the media didn't know what to do. But we don't have that excuse anymore. Like, we know what we're getting ourselves into here.
Yeah. So are you optimistic about voting and elections and 2024, or not so much?
I am more optimistic than not. Is that an appropriate answer to this question? I think I'm really optimistic about quite a lot of things. I think that we're in at least as good of a place, the best place we have ever been in terms of election technology and security. And, you know, I think that the public is sort of apprised to these issues, and the county clerks are sort of trained in communicating with the public and the media in a way that they weren't even in 2020. And that will serve sort of the best interests of the public. I am sort of concerned about the turnover and all of the new folks that will be running elections sometime, some of them for the very first time in 2024. So we're in a moment of real transition, but I don't see any major red flags pointing me to thinking a disaster is on the horizon at this stage.
Yeah. And, you know, I called this show Democracy Optimist, both in terms of a description of how I often feel, but also an aspiration. And I think I hear that a little bit in your answer. So my last question is, what is the one thing you think listeners can do to protect and support democracy? We're already going to talk about signing up for the Vote Beat newsletter. So beyond that, what's the one thing that that listeners can do to support democracy?
Go be a poll worker. I say this hundreds of times a year, but I think my mom, for example, had a lot of the same light sort of doubts as to sort of how the system worked, what went into it, whether or not voter fraud was real. She became a poll worker. She got all of her questions answered in a day. She's a very active participant in the Dallas County Elections Department now, which is like among my greatest successes. But I think that, like, for people who have questions about this, for people who want to support election administrators who they're worried might be getting harassed or don't have enough resources, for people who are concerned that their county isn't doing a good enough job, like, the solution to all of those problems is to just be a poll worker and do it yourself. And that will sort of lighten the load on everyone.
Yeah. You know, is it the famous quote from Tip O'Neill, all politics are local? I think the message here is all elections are local. Jessica Huseman from Vote Beat. Make sure you check out the resources that Vote Beat has. This was such a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Josh, on the matter of optimism, this is Democracy Optimist, after all. And on that matter about the 2024 elections and what shape democracy will actually be in after November the 5th, Jessica Huseman seemed to be cautiously optimistic. And I think a lot of us feel that way right now. Should we?
I think so. I mean, that's how I feel. You know, we called this Democracy Optimist. And, you know, even when you and I were talking about this series and thinking, is that too rosy of a name? But I think we need to be optimistic, because otherwise the answer might be to throw up our hands and think, you know, we can't do anything. The system is, you know, essentially rigged. Although we also need to be cognizant of the challenges that democracy faces. One reason I'm optimistic is the amount of attention that's being paid to these issues. The number of places that are beefing up their voting rights reporting, the number of people who are looking critically at the way democracy works, and the number of people who are clamoring for actual information, for the real truth about how these things operate. So, yes, you know, I'm not naive about the challenges that democracy faces, especially as we talked about with Jessica, with, you know, one of the two major presidential candidates, you know, really challenging democracy itself. And that's not a partisan statement, of course. It's the reality of the sorts of things that one candidate has said. But we need to be optimistic about what's possible while recognizing the challenges, which I think what Jessica was saying as well.
And, you know, I'm thinking if you're concerned that the elections are rigged, one way to get to the bottom of that is to get involved, right? I mean, isn't there, for example, a real shortage of poll workers?
Yeah. I mean, there really is, especially, you know, after the COVID-19 pandemic, with a lot of the poll workers decided not to show up. Certainly, poll workers tend to skew on the older side, and so many of these individuals have not wanted to do it. Now, there's also threats against election officials and poll workers, unfortunately. But the way to respond to that is to not let those who are threatening people win, but to double down in our efforts. You know, democracy's always been about the people taking a stand. We're at an inflection point right now that we all need to do that.
Well, let me ask you to, as we do in each segment here, to single out an election law that all of us ought to be aware of.
So in our conversation with Jessica, we mentioned the Election Assistance Commission, which is a federal agency that exists to help states and localities run their elections. How did this come about? Well, after the Bush v. Gore debacle in 2000, you recall hanging chads and the like in Florida, Congress passed a law, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, to address the problems. And the law did a lot of things. For example, it says that if you're voting in a federal election and you show up to the polls and your name is not on the voter rolls or you don't have the right ID that state law requires, you can't be turned away. Instead, election officials must offer you a provisional ballot, which is basically a ballot that's set aside, and then the election officials determine after Election Day whether that ballot should count. Well, part of that law, the Help America Vote Act, was to create this new agency, the Election Assistance Commission, which helps administer federal funds and gives funds to states to run their elections. Now, the makeup of the commission is kind of interesting. There are four members, four commissioners, two appointed by Democrats and two appointed by Republicans. Sounds great, right? We have some bipartisanship. But you can probably see the problems when we get to the hot button issues. The commission often deadlocks 2-2. In fact, for a while, the commission literally had zero members because no one was confirmed to the positions. So the staff of the commission was basically running the show. Right now, there's some turmoil that VoteBeat has covered. The commission fired its executive director recently, and that person had only been in the role for about a year. The agency doesn't have a permanent general counsel either. So right now, it's the chief information security officer filling in as the executive director. Of course, not great as we enter in an election year. And how did I know about any of this? Because I read a story from VoteBeat.
Well, you know, it's always good to have one of these in your hip pocket when you get into a conversation with friends and family about politics or about the elections and so forth. And that's to have a really good, fun election fact on hand. Can you give us one?
Yeah, and this one's going to relate to something I hear a lot. And so this gets into the myth-busting aspect of our conversations. There's been a big push to require hand counting of ballots instead of having machines do it. You hear this a lot. No, you can't trust the machines. We need to count the ballots by hand after they are cast. But most election experts will tell you that hand counting of ballots is a really bad idea. Why? Because humans aren't very good at rote activities like counting millions of ballots in a short time period. So some researchers have looked into this. One experiment from Rice University asked 40 undergrads to count ballots, and each ballot had 27 political races on it, which is not that absurd in a presidential election year when you have all of the down ballot races. And the undergrads only had to count 120 total ballots. And then they measured how accurate they were 58% of the time. 58% of the ballots were fully accurately counted. Machines can do that much better. Multiply that by thousands, and you can start seeing the problems of having full hand counting of ballots. So experts agree that machine counting with paper ballots so that there's a careful recount possibility if we need to recount a certain subset of the ballots is the best election practice.
Well, I know you always end your interviews with this question. It's a good one, but I'd like to get Josh Douglas's one thing we can do to support democracy.
VoteBeat has weekly newsletters, as I mentioned in the interview with Jessica Huseman. So go ahead and sign up. They come in every Saturday morning is their kind of national newsletter. But interestingly, they also have state-specific newsletters every other week for right now Arizona, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So if you're in one of those states or you're interested, because of course a lot of those states are a hot button states or swing states, go to votebeat.org. You can learn a lot of information. And the nice thing is it's really accessible to everyday voters.
If you're still with us, that says a lot about your interest in and perhaps concerns about the 2024 elections. There's a lot ahead in this series, and you can listen on air, stream online at esweku.org, or find the Democracy Optimist podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or on the NPR app. Among the many voices still to be heard are Fayette County Clerk Susan Lamb and Madison County Clerk Kenny Barger. They're literally on the front lines of elections. And from the Kentucky Supreme Court, Justice Michelle Keller.
If we don't continue to vote, it's certainly not going to get any better. Voting is a right, and those rights have been secured by the blood and by the lives of many, many Americans and Kentuckians who went before us. So to me, it's a sacred right, and you can't take it for granted, and you need to exercise it, even if you're exercising it in an imperfect forum.
We'll hear some words of wisdom from the man regarded as the dean of Kentucky journalists, columnist and educator, Al Cross.
Well, the big obstacle we have is polarization. So I think it's essential that we respect other people's views and we keep an open mind.
We'll be joined by Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, as well as political commentator and longtime Washington Post op-ed columnist E.J. Dion. And voicing concerns heard from many is Amber McReynolds, vice chair of the U.S. Postal Service Board of Governors.
I will say that I am deeply concerned about, again, the impact on disinformation, the lack of knowledge generally in not only the public, but I would say actually a lot of the partisan politicians, when they talk about elections, they are often very wrong and they're telling people the wrong information.
Those are just a few of the many from across Kentucky and the nation joining this effort to send us to the polls in November, fully informed about the workings of American elections. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, me, Tom Martin, series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graver and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist, one word, democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.